Word of mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. I was once invited to Thanksgiving dinner by a friend who warned me that her family was not a real Norman Rockwell kind of bunch. I understood immediately. We all know that image. Brightly scrubbed faces hover in smiling anticipation over sparkling china as Ma sets the turkey in front of the family patriarch to be carved. It's called Freedom from Want, and one of those homespun scenes that only happens in what author Deborah Solomon calls Rockwell Land, a magical place reflecting American life as it should be. Solomon's new biography of the illustrator, beloved by the masses and dismissed as cornball by the art world, reveals a complicated, neurotic, and repressed man who lived very far from the America that he painted. Deborah Solomon is author of American Mirror, The Life and Times of Norman Rockwell, and joins us now from Argo Studios in New York. Deborah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Virginia, that was a beautiful introduction. I don't think I have anything left to say about the painting after your very lyrical description of it.
Well, okay. It's been great talking with you then.
See you next year.
Well, tell us, we do think of his homespun canvases as typifying American values, home and family. But you challenge that in your book, writing that he was not a painter of families. What do you mean by that?
Well, very few of his covers for the Saturday Evening Post, in fact, portrayed an entire family. Most of his covers, in fact, portrayed people in a community who were connected by their civic ties and who tended to be male. He often brought together boys and older men, and in a place such as a barbershop where you wouldn't have many women to begin with. So I would say he was a poet of boyhood.
And he did, beginning at 19 years old, he was illustrating covers for Boys Life magazine and was criticized or called out. People noticed that he did not paint girls.
Well, it was really radical at that time, meaning early in the 20th century, not to paint pretty girls for magazine covers, because most covers featured a kind of pale, delicate-looking woman doing something that didn't require too much energy, like staring at a dove or picking a flower. And Rockwell went up against that tradition of the pretty girl magazine cover. He sometimes was put on the defensive, particularly by female journalists. There were a few who asked him about this. And he was aware that he felt more comfortable portraying boys than girls. You cannot make a feminist or a proto-feminist out of Norman Rockwell.
So he created his own style of illustration and this fabled place that you call Rockwell Land. Bring us there. What goes on in Rockwell Land?
Well, it's a place of safety and security, and it's a place where there can be problems, but where problems have solutions, and the solutions are often provided by the people who live next door to you, if not the girl next door, then maybe the old man next door. And a doctor will make time to hear you out and will not ask you for paperwork and will not ask you who is paying your health insurance. It's a world where Americans will stop and pause and listen to one another and basically take care of one another. It's a very caring place.
You found some very interesting details that were absent from Norman Rockwell's own autobiography, My Life as an Illustrator. What didn't he write about in that book that you wanted to pick up on?
Well, in his book, he tended to tell very long anecdotes, humorous anecdotes. And his sons told me that's what he was like at the dinner table. He would tell very long stories that were humorous, but instead of revealing himself through those stories, he kind of used them as a way to obfuscate himself, as storytellers sometimes do. And I found him to be, upon close inspection, not nearly as humored as he pretended to be and not nearly as amused. He was a man who suffered from a terrible sense of vulnerability and inadequacy and was afraid to be alone in a house. He always had to have people around, did not like being alone, was haunted by all kinds of demons. And I'm not a shrink. I don't pretend to psychoanalyze him in the book. But looking at the literal evidence suggested that he was a man who felt imperiled much of the time. He grew up with an older brother who was much better at sports and who was also a better student. So he had that classic problem of being the 99-pound weakling in his childhood, overshadowed by a perfect older brother. And he never really seemed able to overcome the feelings of extreme inadequacy that his childhood instilled in him.
We're speaking about Norman Rockwell, a favorite American painter, with Deborah Solomon. She's author of the book called American Mirror, The Life and Times of Norman Rockwell. Well, I'd like to pick up on that fascination with boys with you. One aspect of your book that is getting a lot of attention is that he was possibly a repressed homosexual. He says himself that he was not a boy's boy, like his brother Jarvis, as you pointed out, the 98-pound weakling. What does his work reveal about his relationships with men, do you think?
I think, to me, and this is one person speaking, I try not to impose a reading on Rockwell that everyone has to subscribe to. I try to lay out the evidence in my book and let readers decide for themselves. But for me, the work shows a tremendous longing for boyishness. He wants to be around rugged boys. He wants to paint them. And I think that he needed that vision. That was the vision that made him feel like a complete human being. So gender theorists in the 21st century would say that's gay. They would say a man who prefers the company of men to women, does not enjoy even being around women, is gay. On the other hand, I have no evidence of sexual activity with other men, so I would hardly use the label gay to describe him. I think he was very ambivalent in his sexuality, as he was in every other aspect of his life.
What about his relationships with his wives? He was married three times. You make the point that in his autobiography, he barely mentions his first wife. Talk to us about that relationship with women.
He didn't seem to enjoy the company of women. He found them to be a burden, and he always seemed to feel very put upon around women, his wives as well as other women. He didn't have close female friends, and his wives he seemed to experience as a terrible strain. He had two very bad marriages. His first wife left him after 14 years, claiming that he never looked at her or came out of his studio. And she accused him of mental cruelty in the divorce papers. His second wife, Mary Barstow, who was the mother of his three sons, was a really wonderful, elegant, well-educated woman who wanted to be a writer, very sympathetic figure, who was really driven into deep despair and alcoholism as a result of the isolation she experienced in her marriage. But his third marriage was probably his happiest, and he married a schoolteacher in her 60s who had retired. And their relationship was apparently asexual, but provided him with necessary support and companionship.
So his private life was not something that came out in his paintings or his artwork, certainly. And I know you are too disciplined a writer to sort of project what he was thinking, but I'm just wondering how calculating you think he was about separating those traits and his unhappiness and his own kind of psychic pain by creating these cheerful, upbeat images.
I see a lot of him in the paintings. I know a lot of people keep saying to me, oh, his life was so different from his art, but I see some of his alienation in the art. If we talk about the Thanksgiving picture, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Freedom from Want.
Freedom from Want. It's interesting to me that no one in that painting is looking at anyone else.
Yeah, and one is even looking at the camera.
Exactly. One is looking at the camera. That's exactly right. Winking out at us as if to say, can you believe this scene? It's toasty warm, but it also, I think, raises questions about why none of the figures are connected to one another. And we do not have everybody saying grace or bending their head in thanks for turkey and all that they're grateful for. Rather, they're just kind of all looking off in different directions and having fun. I love the painting because I think it celebrates not only American traditions like Thanksgiving, but our ability to laugh at our own traditions. And also the turkey in it is bigger than any turkey that ever appeared on a Thanksgiving table. It's kind of larger than life.
There has been a considerable revival in interest in his work, including a big national tour in 2001 that landed at the Guggenheim, of all places, that kind of temple of modernism. Why do people still look at Norman Rockwell's art?
It's been 35 years since his death. His work has gotten enormous recognition in the art world and continues to gain more recognition. And what's so interesting about him is that even though he made illustrations, they're technically illustrations, right? They appeared on the covers of magazines. They're much more layered than people realize. I don't think they're just simply happy visions of a happy time. I think they just have layer upon layer of meaning. They transcend illustration, and they're category breakers. That's fascinating. They've turned out to have the mystery and staying power of real art.
Deborah Solomon, author of American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. She's also written biographies on Jackson Pollock and Joseph Cornell. Deborah, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Virginia, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. May you have a turkey that's larger than life and perfectly roasted.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Deborah's work and this book in particular at wordofmouthradio.org.